you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million.
If I had $1 million.
Well, I'd buy you a house.
I would buy you a house.
And if I had $1 million.
If I had
Shirley, you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now.
It is May 7th, and it is time for Stocks and Jocks. Chief, a quick set out. We only have one day left before the Fisher House charity event at Revolutionary Brewery at 3340 North Kinsey between 4 and 6 tomorrow. So raise a glass to our heroes and to Chief.
What's up? We have Professor Lou.
Good morning, sir.
Hey, bud. Welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. S&P futures up 6. NASDAQ futures up 15. We got to be up, up, up. Lou, I assume you were long ADM and all these other stuff yesterday and are now even richer than you were before.
Nope.
What the hell? Somebody
I'm
got me long this stuff.
I'm sure I'm richer today than I was yesterday because every day that I'm above ground at this age is a better day than the day before it. So,
well, that's the truth. I was
as one of my Navy SEAL friends said, the only easy day was yesterday.
Well, that's the truth. I was I spent a little time last night with my attorney friends, and I want to use the word like real attorneys, but they deal with the oddest, you know, regular crime. And one of the guys was there was a fight evidently in Evanston, which has a lot of weird laws. It's like a double bad law if you smack somebody over 65, even if you're over 65. How weird is that?
Oh, interesting.
So my friend was
it's like the criminal law equivalent, or the assault law equivalent of sex crimes between, you know, 13 and 14 year olds.
Yeah.
You know, where you have a 16 year old guy dating a 14 year old girl, and you know, they have consensual sex, and that makes the 16 year old a sex offender.
Right. Yeah, it was that was mentioned last night because I asked that question. I said, "What?" I thought if two people underage had sex, it was okay. And he goes, "No, not exactly." So there.
I'm not going to ask how old you are, I will say that I'm over 65.
I'm north of 65.
Yeah. Okay. I will say that I'm over 65. So if I go acting belligerently in a bar in Evanston, and somebody takes a swing at me, in addition to being able to defend myself, the criminal code will come to my aid.
Yes.
Because the guy should know that I'm over 65 and should know better than to try to punch a geriatric person.
Right. So this is such a bizarre thing. The guy and his wife or girlfriend, whatever, over 65, pulls into a handicapped spot for just a second, goes into the store, and a guy is absolutely outraged that he's in the handicapped spot. Behind him,
some bystander?
No, a guy in another car.
Oh, okay.
Starts honking on the horn, and giving the guy, and the lady says, "Sorry, we'll be out in a second. Move your car, we'll move ours, and it's yours." The guy jumps out and grabs her by the hair.
Wait a minute. The guy that was honking had a disabled plate?
Well, I don't know if he did or didn't, but he wanted the spot. Maybe he did. You know, but how many people with disabled plates are really disabled? I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, the fact that he jumps out and assaults the woman is a pretty good indication he's not disabled. Well,
he grabs her by the hair and he yanks her to the ground. So the other guy comes out and like clocks the guy a couple times, like not even in a, just on his arm, just to get him off the lady. So the guy who pulled the lady down is pressing charges on the guy who clocked him on the arm to get him to stop harassing his girlfriend. So the guy went and turned himself in yesterday. This is so bizarre. So he had to go turn himself in. It was a warrant out for his arrest. Because the guy who pulled the lady down issued a complaint.
Why on earth would you attack a woman in a car over something like a parking space?
You haven't seen the road rage around here lately. It's unreal.
I mean, so here, I'll just say, I know Chicago is basically run by communists, but here in Denver, which is also run by communists, you do something like that, you're running a risk of getting a bullet put through you.
Well,
and that goes, you don't attack people in cars, because people in cars frequently have weapons.
Oh, she walked out of the place. The guy was in the car. She walked out to tell him, "Give us a second, we'll move." Just, you know.
Okay, yeah, but okay. So he gets out of his car.
He jumped out of his car and grabs her hair and yanks her down.
Yeah, that's great.
People are crazed.
So I'm gonna move. I got a couple of things to talk about, but we'll start with the bizarre. So imagine you're on an international flight, as I was a couple of weeks ago. You know, so my favorite place, if I'm taking long flights, my favorite place, Tripoli, is Europe, which from Denver is a, you know, an 8 to 10 hour flight. But imagine you're on like a Pacific flight, 15 hours. And the guy, so you're in a premium plus seat. So it's a new seating arrangement that United's got. By the way, United now has seats in economy that you can buy. That you can buy a row if you're like a family. And you can put, they have a bed attachment in economy that allows you to spread out and fill in the area where your seat space would normally be. You can now fill that in with a bed, so that if you're a parent, it was a great idea, if you're a parent with a kid or two, you can actually lie down with your kids to go to sleep in the economy section. Whoa. Which I think is a great move. Anyway, imagine you're in a premium economy seat or premium seat, and the guy next to you,
premium upwards of first class, what first class used to be,
say just whatever the business class is, just below Polaris.
Okay. What can we do?
So,
we're not business and first anymore. We got all these other names.
Well, I think their business class is called Polaris. So let's say you're in whatever just below that is, so that you're in a row. You know, you're not in one of the pods. And the guy next to you takes out a video camera. He's sitting next to the window. So he leaves his window flap up all night. He's got a video camera out, and he's videoing the entire flight and talking. Now, the camera's on him. It's not on you. But the camera's on him. It's got a light on it, and he's talking the entire flight, all 8, 9, 12 hours, because he's an influencer. And
what's an influencer?
Oh, you don't know what an influencer is?
I sort of do, but what's your definition?
Well, it's an influencer is somebody who makes video content, typically video content. It can be audio, but it's always video content for certain product lines or certain activities. And their goal is to try to influence you to either engage in the activity or buy the product. They typically get some kind of sponsoring arrangement with the product. In this case, influencers, and I challenge you, YouTube is full of these guys for flights. You can get on and just look on a vlog, VLOG.
What's he talking about for 8 hours?
He's talking about the seat. He's talking about the food. He's talking about the atmosphere in the plane. He's talking about the flight attendants. He's talking about the club experience. He's editing video while he's going. This goes on for the entire flight.
You're talking to a guy who's never once taken a selfie, so this is so bizarre to me. I can't go there.
And the crew is facilitating this. So, you know, I've watched.
Also, so United's the one who hired the guy.
But they didn't hire him.
Okay.
He's doing this on his own. But they may. It's quite likely they would have comped him the flight.
okay,
or Compton, you know, the upgrade, or whatever, because it's free advertising. If you watch this, you get on and watch this guy's vlog, you'll see, you know, all aspects of what it's like to fly on the airplane and do all this stuff, and they really work to try to cater to these people, because, well, I mean, this one guy that I watched one time has 3 million views on this service.
So I'm going to watch some guy sitting in first class talking about the plane. Clearly, I have something better to do.
30-40 minutes of experience. If you want to say you're planning a trip overseas and you want to find out what it's like flying on United or American or Delta, you can pull up a video of somebody who's taken that flight and who will give you. They'll say, "This is what the club looks like. You know, the upgrade with SkyMiles. This is what the food looks like." You can do that, and people do it. It's anyway. I'm just thinking, I couldn't imagine. I mean, I'd rather have a baby in the seat next to me than some guy jabbering. And again, the flight crew facilitated this.
So they're bugging you too, the flight crew.
Well, the flight crew's standing there helping them out.
Yeah, so I mean, they're bugging you too.
And I'm thinking, United has a rule that says you can't be on a phone and you have to have earbuds in. How is this compatible? How is some guy talking continuously to himself, basically, on this camera? How is this compatible with their rule of no phone calls?
My attorney friend, there are no rules right now from anybody, from the White House on down. I'm not so sure if the White House isn't just reflecting of the rest of the population.
This was not Donald Trump or one of his minions making this vlog.
My point is, everywhere up down, and probably if the next person's Democratic, the entire society now, there are no laws in my mind anywhere.
United, but the thing is, there are. United has kicked. In fact, it's been well documented in the last 3 or 4 months since United put its policy in place. United has kicked people off airplanes and banned people for life from their airplanes for refusing to put headphones in or refusing to terminate phone calls. And
some people, if they don't like you, they can do it.
I'm unaware of a situation where somebody is engaged in making a phone call or using earbuds who refused to stop after they were told to, and that was not either kicked off the flight or banned.
Right. Your key word there, Mr. Attorney, if they were told to. If they like the person, they don't tell them to, like this guy.
I have not seen a single incident of that report.
Okay, well, so here's a guy who talked the whole way, and they didn't
tell
him to stop.
But yeah, and he wasn't technically violating the policy verbatim, but my point is, having somebody like that in the seat next to you is actually worse than somebody, because a phone call eventually ends. You know,
but the rule is, and you know, you're a cancer. The rule is you can't be making noise and bugging the guy next to you. This guy obviously was.
Well, they can't make a rule like that, because then people couldn't travel with small children.
Okay.
The rules are very specific. Headphones, for listening. No phone calls, because you can now with Starlink. United's put a Starlink service on all of their long-haul flights, which is terrific. The video access is magnificent.
What you just text people. You just don't want to. You're not supposed to be talking.
You can now text. Yeah, I mean, I was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and if I wanted to, I could text people back in the.
You no longer have to shut your phone off when you're on a plane.
Your phone does have to be shut off. The cell system has to be shut off. You go on Wi-Fi.
Okay.
So you turn on your Wi-Fi, activate the phone's Wi-Fi, and that Wi-Fi.
But you go to the page where it says airplane mode, and you hit that, so you're shut off.
Yep. And the Wi-Fi then connects with the plane's Wi-Fi, and you're now tied into Starlink, which gives you email access if you wanted email access, text access, whatever. On some of the aircraft, depending on your seat, the text is free. And so I could text somebody. I had a conversation with somebody else in the airplane that was, you know, rows behind me, but I could text them and say, "Hey, this is going on. You know, here's what's going to happen. You know, the next gate, et cetera, et cetera."
You have heard my story about Dr. J and the Wi-Fi on the plane.
On a plane?
Yeah, so it's a while ago. Of course, John's Mr. First Class, you know, a guy like you.
So but both of you guys are Luddites.
No, he isn't. No, he definitely is not. I mean, he's been on this stuff, you know, way before anybody else was. So he sits down in first class, and the first thing he does is pop into the Wi-Fi. I would never even think of that. I've never been on Wi-Fi in my life. After he told me this story. So he sits down, and the guy next to him is, you know, Mr. Computer Guy, evidently. And he says to him, "Hey, John, you want me to tell you your password?" He goes, "What?"
Yep.
And he goes, "Get on Wi-Fi. I can tell you. Anybody that kicks into Wi-Fi, I can tell you their password. See that lady over there? This is her password." John goes, "You got to be kidding me." He goes, "No, Wi-Fi is the easiest thing in the world to hack into."
So there.
So that's...
That's interesting because Starlink.
Maybe you can't do it in Starlink. I don't know, but you know.
Trust me, for first class, and if they're encouraging people to use it for email, security's got to be pretty good, in terms of your individual connection.
What kind of plane is this? A 787 or what is it?
777. The influencer was on a 767, I think.
Which is one of my favorite planes. I love those things.
Yeah. And but when I was the last experience I had was a 787.
You like those?
Oh yeah. Yeah. The flying experience now is so crazily different than it was even 10 years ago. And of course, you and I remember when they were showing, you know, 35mm film on long flights.
I remember when the Braniff girls wore Gucci gowns.
And they would have one screen in front. So now, almost every, even on domestic flights, almost every seat has its own individual screen.
I mean, you could just bring a book, but nobody does that anymore, right?
People do bring books. I mean, but, you know, for a 15-hour flight, you can only read so much.
Yeah.
And so you can put headphones in that give you a quality sound experience. You can either watch video on the screen on your seat back, or you can watch video on your phone or tablet if you have one of those that you can plug into their Wi-Fi. It's crazy. And the amount of stuff that's available, I don't have an Apple TV streaming service, but on the airplane, you know, they do. So I watched four or five Apple TV series that I haven't seen. It got all the way through, two seasons. It was fantastic.
The longest flight I was on was
you will be gratified to know the food still sucks. Oh, it's terrible.
It used to be good. That's well, before it was deregulated. That's how they competed, basically, was how hot the stewardesses were and how good the food was.
Well, the food has remained terrible for the last, as far as I can tell, three decades, and this was no exception. I mean, maybe I think if you watch the vlog guys, if you watch an influencer riding in first class, they have much better food. But back in steerage where I typically fly, it's not so hot.
My uncle, he used to repair and install huge printing presses, right? So those guys went everywhere. And he said if you flew to L.A., you wanted to fly Braniff. In first class, they would bring out this huge cart with a massive prime rib on it, and you could tell them where to put the knife, which side you wanted, because the food was incredible.
If you look again, if you watch these influencer videos, if you pull one up, two things will jump out at you. One, the club experience, which is where if you're flying first class, and most of these guys do, almost nobody makes a video from economy for good reason. This latest experience that was reported yesterday with this guy sitting next to you vlogging and talking the whole time is why these vlogs are almost always made in first class or business class, where they have their own individual pod where they can sit and jabber all they want.
Wow.
But if you watch these, the food, the wine selection, the 3 and 4 star chef experience, it's all there for that price. of course, that price, I mean, I don't know if you've
it's
looked
like
at what...
It's like three times as much as regular, isn't it?
It's at least three times as much. And it's, you know, it's very, very... I mean, but the amenities are fantastic.
If you have three or four people, you're almost better off getting a private jet.
Just about.
Yeah.
So anyway, this was the latest... This is the latest outrage on flying, and I've watched, as I said, I've watched these influencer videos on YouTube, but they're always, I've never seen one where the guy is sitting next to somebody in a passenger, you know, an economy or economy premium passenger setup, and is talking, and it just never occurred to me that somebody would be A, that rude, or B, that stupid to do something like that, because
they don't even think they're rude. They think they're entitled.
I'm sure of.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that was. That just jumped out at me I'm thinking.
One thing's for sure: when you transfer, it's nice to be able to go into like the United Lounge and so forth. Those are pretty nice. So, John and I are flying. We're real young, you know. And so, of course, his dad, being the surgeon, has got a gazillion miles at United, right? So John's got. Well, he's out. Don't worry. I'll get us into the club. He walks up and. The guy says, "Who are you?" I'm Dr. John Najarian. The guy looks, sees it. John's dad's like 60, and he goes, "You don't look 60 to me. You two guys get out of here." We got booted.
Glad to hear that security works. So let me give you the ultimate perk, and this is associated with the frequent flyer program. So my kid is flying out of, I think it's Greenville, South Carolina, you know, near Charlotte. And so it's a regional jet. He's flying back to Chicago on a regional jet, and he's been wedged in. There's I can't remember if they, I think they had a first class, but he had to go standby, and they ended up putting him in first class. So and there's an empty seat next to him, so he's in first class, and they're taxiing out. They taxi out. They get about 2/3 of the way to the runway, and then the plane stops. And the pilot goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, sorry, there'll be a slight delay." So my kid looks out the window, and this car drives up to the airplane. They open the front door and extend the stairs. This guy with his bag gets out of the car, and then walks over, climbs up the steps, climbs into the airplane, and plops into the seat next to my kid. And then they close the hatch, and the plane taxis and takes off. And my son goes, starts making conversation with this guy and says, "So, you know, are you the president of United Airlines or something like that? Because that was pretty impressive." And the guy goes, "No, I'm a 3 million mile flyer." And for 3 million mile flyers, if you have a late arrival and the airplane is still physically within the confines of the airport, they will stop it and drive you out to the plane.
That's really get something. You on anybody board. Else, once they back off, the plane will be right there, and you're... That happened to me once, where they put the, what do you call it, the jetway?
Yes.
They backed up, and they said, "Oh, they'll never put the jetway out again." Of course they do. The guy sits right next to me. He's the guy who worked for United and went around the country buying, like, new motors to put on the planes or something.
Yeah, well... You know, to be just a regular 3 million, a regular customer, to do that. So, I guess my kid said something like, "I bet that feels pretty good when they do that." He goes, "I must admit, it's not bad for your ego."
Well, we back when TWA, remember they were always going to go out of business, then they didn't. Well, so we're going to Europe for, and so Jan gets these tickets for TWA, right? So we're going first class. So we get to Canada. I'd never been on a flight more than 4 hours, which is plenty for me. So all of a sudden, for those that don't remember, TWA had the ultimate hub and spoke type of situation out of Kennedy Airport in New York, where every city, no matter where you're from, if you're going to Columbus, Chicago, whatever it is, and you're flying to London, every plane from here landed in Kennedy. And they had, I don't know how many zillion people they had on the ground, Lou, but all these planes landed between 4 and, say, 4:30. I mean, we're talking just popping them in there. All the planes to Europe left between, like, 6 and 6:45. And there's a fleet of these 747s, the old ones. And they look like, you know, geese going up. There's so damn many of them. So we get on ours and we're going to London. And so they're waiting this long line, and you look in front of you, see all these 747s in front of you. We get to the front and the guy pulls out. And he goes, well, we couldn't, we set our satellite navigation system and it didn't work. So we got to go to the end of the line and reset it and try again. So this is another hour creeping up. Get to the front, and he pulls off again. I'm sitting there going, I've already been on this crate 2 hours, we're never going anywhere. Sure enough, something comes up. They open the front door, a little cherry picker. And this guy comes in with basically a pair of coveralls and this box. He's going to put the new one in the dashboard.
Yep.
So he screws around for 45 minutes. They get back in line. The pilot goes, we're good to go. We got a good one. And off we go. I'm going, I've already been 3 hours on this pig. And we're not even off the ground yet. But, you know, it comes down to that. The guy goes, oh, don't worry, we could find London without it. It's just a precaution. I'm going, that's just swell. we could dead reckon there if we had to. But
actually, at that point, they could. That's a good question. So modern aircraft run off of GPS, but because GPS signals can be, you know, interfered with, and they are right now across Eastern Europe and across the Mediterranean. They have back, you know, they have an internal radar system that allows them to navigate off landmass, and they have, I think they still use inertial. So inertial navigation is, I mean, at one time before GPS was a thing, inertial navigation was developed and refined down to such an art that literally your internal inertial system could get you within a mile or so on basic navigation, could get you within a mile or so of your destination after, you know, X number of hours. And it's completely internal. But if you crash that system, you're in trouble. I don't know if they still keep inertial on those aircraft.
I have no idea.
The systems have now been refined down to where there are inertial navigations. You know, they used to be a box about the size of a coffee maker. Now they're about the size of a nickel, I think. And you know, you can be inserted into all kinds of things, like cell phones. Cell phones have an inertial.
But you're not unless you're going to Spain or someplace. I mean, you're not really deadheading across the ocean. I mean, if you're going to London, you're basically going over Iceland and Newfoundland. Can't you pretty much use the ground stuff and know where you're at, where you are?
No, you're over. Sometimes the routes will touch Greenland, but a lot of times you're not within radar range at that altitude is what, 150 miles maybe, okay, line of sight. So you're not within line of sight of a land for a lot of that flight. Now dead reckoning with airspeed and wind and plotting, dead reckoning can get you pretty close, as long as your weather forecast is okay.
Hey, can I ask you a question regarding economic numbers and people's, let's say, people's sanity or people's wealth or health and wealth. I don't know if you know, but on Wednesday now we have Russell's been nice enough to introduce us to a Dr. Larissa Demiak.
I saw her name.
And she is special because she teaches at Purdue and she teaches budgeting and those kinds of things to kids and teaches, you know, how to investing and those kinds of things. So she's really in tune with it. But yesterday we got on a subject that is, you know, and this has always been close to my heart, probably because I get stuck. I only had to take nine classes in a business school at the University of Chicago, so I took 11, as many as I could, in economics. So it gives you a whole different view of the world than just a business class. And we took two quarters I took of a history of economic thought, where they went from, agrarian revolution to industrial revolution, and just how things get counted all along the way. And I listen to, you know, CNBC all day, and the market's going up, and people are, you know, there's a couple ladies on CNBC that I almost want to shoot the TV when they come in. They keep talking about, and Larissa was going through this yesterday like by a fine-tooth comb, and they'll say the consumer's strong. Look at consumer spending. Consumer's fine. And Larissa was saying, when you have an inflationary environment, and she has a family, so she goes, okay, the gas has cost me more, home heating's cost me more, not home heating, but they heat the home, because everything's cost me more. So we've cut back from, going to breakfast once in a while. It's too expensive. We'll go out and have a pizza or something, because actually it's cheaper. And or we don't go. And she's talking about how people rearrange their stuff, and she goes, the people are probably correct in the sense that because the prices are higher, I'm actually spending more than last year.
But I'm getting less.
And actually, if one of the kids sprains an ankle and I go to the emergency room, well, that's $500 or $1,000 deductible that I probably haven't budgeted for, and that goes on my credit card. So she goes, well, actually, in terms of an inflationary environment, I'm spending more than last year. And basically, sure. if you're a dummy or you're talking your book, you can say the consumer is flush. She goes, it's exactly the opposite of that. It's exactly the opposite of that. I'm spending more, yes. So in gross numbers, if you wanted to be a dummy, you could say I'm flush. But I look at it, and I'm worse than I was last year.
The most insightful thing I think I ever heard on this kind of discussion was from a woman. I hesitate to use the word housewife because I don't know if she was looking, but
well, Larissa's a housewife and a professor, so she's
yeah. But she was. Let's just say this woman was a housewife in addition to whatever else she was. But what she said was great. She said, "Yeah, I practice macroeconomics," and the interviewer goes, "What do you mean? I don't understand." And she goes, "Well, macroeconomics to me means I'm eating macaroni. We're eating pasta.
Yep.
Where we would be eating meat. And so when this economy starts to tank like this, I'm reverting back to macaroni and cheese and spaghetti and tomato sauce versus hamburger or ribeye or whatever. So that's macroeconomics." And I thought, that is genius. That is absolute genius. Because that's as clear an indication as I've ever heard of economic impact and policy, policy effects. So I offer that out for your economics assistant,
I'm curious, Lou, whenever anybody does something, and I have, whoever comes on, I always have my same story. Before, because I used to do this, before you do anything in terms of an investment, whatever it is, buy a ball team, buy a machine, somewhere in the back of your feeble or good brain, there is some view of what the world's going to look like going forward. Now, clearly, if you got a plumbing company and you're doing good and you buy another pickup truck, you don't have to really have a 10-year plan, right? You just know you need a pickup truck. But if it's a machine, it's going to cost you X. If Pullman was going to buy another machine, it was going to be $500,000. Well, you better think you're going to get another railroad contract, or what are you buying it for, right? I mean, there's always a point of view on this stuff, and I look at this people's view of inflation, and I'm going to blame, I guess, the attorneys. I don't know, there's been a couple of union settlements here, Lou, of contracts. One of the, I don't even remember the name of the place, with some union, I don't know what the hell they were doing, it was hospital or what it was. They've been without a raise for like a year. And they just signed up a new contract for a 14% raise over the next 3 years. And I sit there and go, what in God's name are they doing? Those people aren't even going to break even. And somebody, some other union, has using the CPI as their accelerator going forward. I go, God bless. I need to give these guys a two-hour economics class. What are they doing? How does anybody not think that a 14% raise over the next 3 years, make it 4 years because they haven't had one a year, how is that not a losing deal? It's not even close.
But you're not looking, the negotiation perspective is not necessarily am I gonna break even. It's what I can get out of the employer.
I know, but they thought they were gonna break even. they thought they scored a huge win.
I mean, I will tell you, having been on both sides of negotiating union agreements, that the company is hamstrung to a certain extent it's hamstrung by the greed of the employers and by economic conditions that the company's business is facing. The union or the employee's negotiating position is hamstrung by the foolishness of the workforce and its susceptibility to short-term gratification and the infrequently limited understanding of economic conditions on the part of the union leadership, and which may be another variation of the ignorance of the workforce. But to get a sports reference in here, and I want to talk about NIL a little bit.
Oh yeah, please,
if we can. But to get a sports reference in here, when the NFL Players Association was negotiating its contracts back in the aughts, they had, I mean, every year I went to the agent course at the combine, and it's an all day presentation, and one of the things that they hammered on us was to tell our clients, our player clients, that this negotiation or this contract that they'd signed or this or that contract was actually a more valuable contract for the players because of the benefits package that was being negotiated and the long term, especially medical benefits that had been put in place to help these guys out down the road. And the present day value of that stuff was substantial. At which point one of the agents stood up, a very smart guy, but who had a lot of experience with players, and said what I think everybody in the room was thinking. He said, you understand, of course, he said, that the guys you are representing do not give one whit about benefits that are going to attach to them in even 5 or 6 years. All they care about is how much money is in their pocket today.
But you're also talking about a very specific, a bunch of people who, as Bill Murphy said to me once, if there wasn't the NFL, you'd need another prison. You're talking about those people going against the monopoly. But
this is a workforce. It's a workforce that's, I mean, it's a very highly paid workforce.
But your workforce is 23 years old.
It's not that much different, but it's not that much different than, I mean, those kind of considerations are not that much different than a normal laborers union or a teachers union. How much money am I getting now? And that's a huge issue for a lot of people. So when you negotiate these contracts, a lot of times a union will come in and say, look, here's how much, you know, we need. And the employer said, all right, I can't give you that much. What I can do, however, because you've got an election coming up next year, what I can do is front load. Here's how much we can give you. What I can do is front load that so that your workforce gets like a 7 or 8% bump in the first year of the contract. It drops 2% or 3% after that. But we can give you a 7 or 8% bump in the upcoming year so that your guys have more money in their pocket and for the election year, and they'll vote for you.
Well, I don't doubt any of that, but when you have a inflationary situation, which we have, and we're not admitting to, all this should be off the chart. Because I mean,
I agree, but this is not you're dealing with people, and you know as well as I do.
But you're dealing with football players.
No, you're dealing with people, and so if you come in and you throw money at them in the short term, that's what they.
I would have.
That's what they want.
I'm not disagreeing, just to be radio-like, but I think your view of benefits if you're 35 with two kids is a lot different than if you're 23 and a football player.
It is, but I'm just saying that mentality carries over into virtually every union contract that I've seen.
But you're talking about a bunch of guys that every one of them, if they're not an absolute moron,
I'm talking about regular. Yeah. Like teachers' contracts, okay, which I've negotiated, or coal miners' contracts.
Let's not forget the NIL, because as I don't know if you saw yesterday, I think yesterday or last week, the Indiana legislature basically approved, I don't know how you could prevent it, but they approved NIL for high school kids, which was following Illinois and all these other states. What does that mean?
Well, from my perspective, it means that you have a bunch of people who cannot be legally obligated to follow the terms of a contract signing contracts for substantial amounts of money. I think it means we might be moving in the direction of a kind of trade school program for athletes. So if you're a really good high school athlete, you know, you're gonna get diverted into the jock trade school track for high school education, as opposed to somebody who's really good in academics.
Rocks for jacks and that kind of stuff?
Well, so in Germany, for example, in eighth grade, I think it is, or our equivalent of eighth grade, maybe seventh grade, you take a test. And if you're a guy with good academic skills and literate and good math skills and things like that, and you score well on the test, you go into a college track starting in eighth grade. If you are not so bright or not so well educated,
as Fred Sanford would say, a dummy,
and you bust the test, you are tracked into trade school. You're going to a school that's going to teach you how to bend metal and you know, run a lathe or run a drill press or whatever. But you're not going to college, buddy. And that determination is made in eighth grade.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, you can break out of it, but in the public schooling system, that's what they do, and everybody knows it. And so that, you know, that's one of the reasons German kids tend to be, or used to be, a little more serious about their education. Japanese have a variation of the same program.
Well, you know, one of the
if we throw the financial incentive in there, you now create a reason to take these football players, basketball players, tennis players, baseball players, to take them out of the normal high school track because they're getting paid, unlike their peers whose payoff is somewhere down the road. These kids are getting paid now.
Right.
So you are now going to put them in, I think, an incentive is to put them in the drill press metal bender track. It won't be for that. It'll be a track that basically maximizes practice time. So you maximize revenue. I could see that easily happening. Okay, sorry. Wanted to finish that thought before
I
lost it.
One of my friends who's a big shot, but he's on the board of one of the Catholics. I have a couple guys that are, but the boards of these Catholic schools, for kids that think they're going to get a college football scholarship, the biggest demand now of going to high school is they want to be able to graduate in 3.5 years without, you know, because the colleges now, if they're going to pay you as a freshman, they don't want you
showing
up.
Yeah, they
want
to bring you in as soon as possible.
Yeah, they want you to do a spring practice. They don't want you to bring you in August.
Yep.
And it's pretty scary when you look at the percentage of these people that actually make it to... Actually, probably the people that get paid in college now is probably pretty high. I mean, it's no longer just people that make it to the pros because you can have a nice college career, right?
That's right. They're not looking... I mean, the colleges are not looking at the pro prospects on these kids. They're looking at the guy who's going to be able to help the college win and help the college make money. So that's why they're trying to bring him in early.
Where do you see this all kind of... I won't say breaking apart, but breaking away from... the academics whatsoever. I mean, Rick Dellinger, God, it's had to be 30, 40 years ago.
Yep.
And his book said it's going to be college-sponsored school, and you're going to have a University of Michigan's going to have some kind of
a theater.
Community college. It's part of Michigan, so theoretically you're in Michigan, but you're nowhere near the regular university.
I mean, we have a system that we can look at that does exactly this, and it's FIFA. The international soccer program. So they start identifying kids at 10, maybe even earlier than that, 10 or 11 who look like they have potential skills to be international soccer player. And those kids' families sign contracts. Those kids are frequently taken out of school. They go to a FIFA club system, They get some education. There's some kind of schooling associated with it. But the kid basically goes to boarding school for the rest of his, you know, the rest of his life until he becomes an adult. He's in a FIFA program where he's got a contract. He's contractually obligated to the team. The family gets money. He's contractually obligated to the team. That team develops him as a youth soccer player. He's then passed along through the club system with the contracts moving from place to place until he gets into the, you know, if he gets into the major leagues. But his contract is, as a kid, his contract is sold or traded or moved, and the developing the programs that develop him get a cut of whatever that contract is, the next contract is, so that they are incentivized to develop players for the system. But what happens is those kids are effectively removed from their normal, what you and I would consider to be a normal childhood education and development program.
Well, that's my buddy from Germany said, "Why U.S. is the only place that confuses college with essentially sports."
Well, that's right, and you know, one of the first things I noticed when I went over to the UK, I was talking about college sports, and they said, "We don't have anything like that, except maybe Oxford and Cambridge rowing, or rugby, but we don't have anything like that. Our clubs develop, you know, swimming. Our clubs develop our athletes. Our swimming clubs develop our swimmers. Our soccer clubs develop our soccer players."
What was the relationship between? I know they were totally independent for a while, and they fought the NCAA. And the NCAA always kind of won these battles. The original AAU.
Yeah, the Amateur Athletic Union. Yeah, I was just thinking of that.
But now they're sort of coming back in some ways. But I remember again when I was very young, the University of Chicago had the University of Chicago Track Club.
Yep.
They were not affiliated. Yeah. Well, they sort of were.
The best swimming programs in the United States when I was swimming competitively in high school, the best swimming programs. Indiana had a good college program. So SoCal had a good college program, but the best swimming programs were people like the Tulsa, Oklahoma Pepsi Marlins, or
really?
Bartlett, Oklahoma Pepsi Marlins, or the swim club out of Miami, swim club in South Florida that was just spectacular. And that's, you know, when you looked at the Olympian affiliations, they were not affiliated with college teams. They were affiliated with these AAU clubs. It's all gone.
And what was the death knell for that? There was some massive legal ruling that the people from AAU couldn't participate in the NCAA. There was some story where they used to let, like, the people from the University of Chicago Track Club could actually go to the NCAA swimming champ. There was something that the NCAA wanted them out. They wanted to be the main spot. And they won a couple of legal cases. I'm talking 40 years
ago. The NC2A won, I believe, I'm reaching back now, the NC2A won legal ruling saying that as a private organization or as a member-driven organization, it could vote to exclude these athletes from participating in NC2A events. And the AAU programs, you know, at their heart were parent-driven volunteer operations with a quasi-professional angle on them as the kids got older. The AAU organizations couldn't compete. They were prohibited from getting into the NC2A competition, and they were prohibited from having access to NC2A facilities because the NC2A, you know, as a private, member-driven organization.
Then they cut down to like high school level.
Pardon me?
And then they cut down to like high school level.
Yes, and they stayed at high school level, but even then, you know, that wasn't sufficient. So AAU swimming devolved into U.S. swimming. AAU basketball devolved into U.S. basketball, and they became officially aligned with and linked to our Olympic programs.
And well, they still have AAU basketball, and I guess in California it's huge flag football in the summer. All your big time quarterbacks play AAU in the summer. They just play, they play flag.
Don't know about that one. Well, I have experience with that. I followed swimming pretty closely, and we represent U.S. swimming
One of my good friends, his daughter was a big star at Loyola basketball. Well, actually, her number's retired in three sports, but basketball was, they won a state championship, and he said she would play more games for AAU than she ever did for Loyola. But there was a school, Loyola was a big school here, and there was a school in, a Catholic school in Seattle or somebody. Somehow or another, in the summer, the AAU managed to get, the two dioceses could never get a game, right? But the AAU managed to get everybody from the Loyola team at a big tournament in Minnesota, and they played the people from Seattle or wherever it was. They were real strong for a while. And then they used to have all your big schools like Notre Dame or places, they would have one of the early basketball games. They would play against one of these AAU things so they could give these guys some money. And the NCAA said, you can't do that anymore. Remember that?
Yep.
Hey, just as an aside, I keep bringing up this inflation stuff, and I don't want to beat this a dead horse, but I look back at the poster child for inflation, which was 1919 to 1923 Germany, the Weimar Republic. And what I say to this, Lou, is that the people like Trump, okay, him because he owns a bunch of stuff, which most presidents don't. The people who own stuff are amazingly benefited by this kind of stuff. If you look at $1 in 1914 in Weimar Germany, the value of it ended up being a thousand or 3,000 marks to the dollar from one. And when you look at their stock market in 1919 was basically $1,500. By the end of the inflationary period, the stock market was a trillion. So when you see our inflation now, what's happening, and you see this market going up, I'd like to tell my clients it's all me, but you know what? It's not, Lou. And the people who made out like a bandit, and some of them probably are still the grandparents of people we have here, all the farmers in Germany in 1 year were able to pay off their mortgages.
Right. And yeah, because the value of the
value of the money. Anybody who has a fixed debt to somebody is a massive winner in inflation. If you don't, you're not. And anybody thinks that this is just kind of, when I was younger, I would say
this is the old line about inflation. You should be investing in what we in the law business referred to as chattels.
Yeah,
property, tangible stuff.
But it's not just investing; it's borrowing.
Right. Because the present dollar value is decreasing.
If you pay $200,000 for a place, and in 5 years from now sell it for $500,000, that's cool. But if you put down $20,000, borrowed the rest, now you're up $320,000 on your $20,000, not on the $200,000. Or three. I mean, you've made it. The leverage is dramatic, and that's why the leverage in the stock market is what makes the market go up. You could do it anyway, but you could call me today and say, hey, Chief, buy me 1,000 shares of IBM. I can get you 100, what is it, it's trading 227. You only have to send me 113.5. I'll get you the loan for the rest. Now, what other place can you and I get a $113,000 loan in 10 minutes?
Yeah.
Yep. If you and I buy a house,
I get it, and there's going to be an accounting, there's going to be a reckoning,
but I don't want to see that because I know the reckonings on borrowed money are worse. If there wasn't borrowed money, I wouldn't care. You put up $220,000 and you were up $20,000 for a while, and now you're down $20,000. It's not the best thing in the world, but it's not the same as you borrowing half of it and all of a sudden you lose everything. Right, if down 50%, you're not going to lose everything, correct?
Yep.
I mean, the leverage, and Hal's been leading on this. I will say that in that he the banking laws of the last 20 years, and again, I'm not blaming on any single president, but matter of fact, probably was the Dodd-Frank was what, under Obama, right? I don't remember that. But the banking laws, it's so much different than the Milton Friedman world where you put money into the system and eventually everything inflates and everybody gets hurt. He goes, now only certain people can access this money, and they're the big winners, and other people can't. And you and I, if we put up the same $112,000 on, I'm talking about an IBM, and bought a rundown house and went to the bank and said, you know, in this neighborhood, this house fixed up is worth $400,000. It's going to cost us $113,000 to. They're not going to give us a loan unless we sign over our houses and our kids and God knows what else. The difference between that and being able to get a loan in the market is dramatic. Or to get a loan for, and you know, and the people who are able to get a loan, I'll say, for the Doral or any place like that, it's they're not even on the same planet. I mean, if you can get a loan for a baseball, look at these guys from GameStop. They're going to buy eBay. GameStop.
Yep.
They don't have a. You know, it's not like in that world they don't have a pot to piss in. Well, yet they got stock, and somebody is going to give them a loan to take over another place. I mean, if PTI had, you know, 90 bazillion shares outstanding. By the way, we're a partnership, not even a corporation. And somebody was dumb enough to take our stock for their company. I guess I'd do it. Wait a minute. You're going to take PTI stock for eBay? I'll take eBay for nothing. I mean, this is bizarro world, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, and it's going to get more bizarre, I think, given what's going on.
Are we hoping that maybe this war is over this week? I'm hoping.
No. Nope, I'm not.
Really, I wish it was, but
we need more pressure on the bad guys. But that's just me. I'm going to run. Okay, I see Andrew and Wayne are up. You guys have a terrific day and a terrific weekend. And we'll talk to you next week.
You're going jogging?
As a matter of fact, I am.
Well, good for you, bud. SP Peter's up 7, Nasdaq's up 9. Do we have our guys, Jimmy?
Oh, you have me here down in the swampland.
Good morning from D.C.
Do you think, I was thinking about Wayne. We watched a golf tournament a few weeks ago, Andrew, where the guy had the ball by the water, and there was a gator sitting right there, and the guy was like a foot from the water, and the guy didn't want to go near his ball, and the gator wouldn't move. I think of Wayne down there in Florida with all these gators and then him.
Except well, you know, scared of him.
Well, you know, down here in Florida, any body of water, no matter how small, can contain one or more alligators. And that's why even after a heavy rain, I stay away from rain puddles because you just never know here. By the way, I was just looking at a photo. I guess Marco Rubio just had his meeting earlier today with your Southside Pope Leo. Marco didn't look very happy, but I noticed on the Pope's he had a very wry smile, which I can only assume is that he probably schooled Marco and some things that he wanted to get off his chest.
Anybody that educated that has done missionary work and seen the worst parts of the world for his whole life is not going to be intimidated by anybody.
No, especially by somebody like Marco who, you know, well, I've done a lot of diving on his background, and let's just say he's a somewhat manufactured politician. I did think it was funny that there's a story that Pope Leo wanted to change his phone number on his Chicago bank account. And I don't know if you saw this story, but he called the bank and he said, "Listen, I'd like to change the phone number you have listed on my account." And the woman said, "Well, I have to ask you a series of security questions," which he did, and he answered them correctly. And she said, "Well, we have a policy now. You've got to come into the bank personally for us to authorize this change." And he said, "Would it help if I told you that I'm Pope Leo?" And she hung up the phone.
Well, you remember the scene in The American President where he tried to call the girl and she refused to believe it was him and called him back, got the White House?
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah, I tell you what, the attendance at Catholic services in Chicago is going through the roof since this guy's been Pope.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah. Oh, by the way, all over the world, there are reports that attendance is high, and there's a lot of lapsed Catholics that are returning to the church.
Yeah, one of my friends, she went to the Good Friday thing, which I had to go to when I was a kid. It's like a 4-hour event, you know, where the stations and the cross and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I might get back into the flow, but it'd be a while before I did that. And she goes, it was SRO. She goes, last year there was nobody there. It was SRO. I go, you got to be kidding me. Somebody's going to stand through that. I mean, good Lord. I don't know if I want to be that holy, but anyway, guys, I don't know if you had a chance to listen. That discussion with Larissa yesterday regarding numbers and the idea that I economic buffoons are not regular, they're not buffoons as people, but on CNBC they keep talking about how the consumer is strong, they remain strong, and Larissa teaches classes in home budgeting and in investments and things, and by the way she has a couple of kids, so she's kind of like a professor housewife if ever there is such a thing. And she talks about, I'm spending more than last year, but not on what I want, and I'm forced to do it because the stuff is so expensive that the necessities now eat up my whole salary. She goes, and if you look at the gross numbers, you could say I'm strong, but I'm wounded. I'm not strong. What are you talking about? Putting $20 more in the gas tank and then not taking the kids to breakfast, I guess the numbers come out the same way, but it's not strong. I don't know what word you want to use. But you could be dumb enough to say, oh, man, obviously she's doing fine. Well, she's not doing as fine. I mean, how do you split that out, Andrew, in terms of, I mean, it's a subjective sort of thing rather than a objective. I mean, if you're in Washington, you go, hey, it looks to me like retail sales are fine. Well, sure they are. Everything's up in terms of price. If they wanted to, how could they split that out? And they surely don't want to. I mean, how would you
do that? Well, here's an analogy that comes to mind. I'm drawing from my forefathers, downstate Illinois farmers. It might be called eating your seed corn or something like that. I think that's what you're saying with your analogy. It's in the long run, just like your conversation before we came on with Lou, talking about comfort or at least complacency in the current time that can't likely continue. And it's just a question of when it goes south.
Well, yeah, because you really don't want that to happen. And it comes out to, I mean, Larissa talks a lot about the K-shaped recovery. And I keep hearkening back to the crash of 29, which I don't want to see again. But at some point, you just can't have Wayne and five others buying some massive yacht instead of 10,000 people buying a bass boat. It's just not economically healthy, and it doesn't get you there. It's like Duesenbergs cost, 30 times more than a Model A, right? So I guess if you sold 10 Duesenbergs in 1929, you thought you were in Fat City, but you're really not, are you?
Right.
I don't know. Do you think Wayne could be... you think he could captain that Russian yacht you guys sent me a picture of?
Oh, well, I noticed Jeff Bezos has his yacht up for sale, so I was thinking about maybe putting a deposit on it. I don't know if they'd take a $10 deposit. But.
Oh, you were in the Navy. Does that mean you could hop in the captain's chair of that thing and just fire it up and go?
You know, it's funny. Most people I have known who've actually lived on boats, not yachts, but the size where you could actually live somewhat comfortably, none of none of them knew how to pilot their own vessels. They had to hire these rent-a-captains if they had to move it anywhere.
God. Well, I remember when I first went to San Francisco and we scooted over to Sausalito, which is an amazing place. This one area, they had all these houseboats. They looked pretty nice. And years later, I went and they were all kind of gone. Did they figure out a way to get rid of them or what? Were these,
Well, a lot of people chose to live on boats. In D.C., for example, there's a marina down on the Potomac, actually a sort of a tributary, small tributary of the Potomac. They used to live there. I knew somebody who lived there, and one of his neighbors was Associate Justice David Souter on the Supreme Court. So a lot of people chose to live there because it was cheaper. But I would imagine, and this may be the case in San Francisco, where, you know, living on a boat was a lot cheaper than property in that area. But, you know, slip fees and stuff like that are probably have gone sky high. And in some cases, you have to have sort of a club membership.
Is the Potomac freshwater or is the saltwater back up in the thing?
Well, from what I know, it's fresh water until it starts to turn brackish, where it widens, and it starts to get wider sort of south of Washington.
Okay.
By the time you get down to the Chesapeake, of course, it's mostly salt water, but of course that's the water that oysters like to live in, and crabs. And unfortunately, with pollution, both of those populations have hit it rough. And you know, the oystermen and the crab fishermen have had it rough for I'd say several decades now.
Really, we don't want to get into politics too heavy here, other than what your view on the elections in Indiana, but I saw something. Now it's on a Democratic type of thing, but what was the story the other day? Was Trump having the kids that won the fitness challenges and stuff in the White House and telling them that the only reason why they were there is because he took out Iran or they would have been killed by a nuclear bomb?
Yeah.
What was he talking
about?
Yeah,
and then with one... One girl, he said she was too small for one sport, and said she ought to try soccer instead. And it was, first of all, I don't know why they allow him, you know, near children, because I mean, he's obviously suffering from dementia right now, and he was all over the map. He used the occasion to start talking about transgender in sports. And you know, there was one girl though, if you saw the video, she's standing off to his left. I'd say she's about maybe 10, 11 years old. She rolls her eyes quite visibly during Trump's. And I'm sure the Democrats are looking at her for a possible, you know, future run after she's of age. Yeah. But I think her eye roll was shared by many other people at that point in time.
Andrew, I was dying to have you guys on this morning. I was reading about this Indiana election. For those that don't, there were 7 people that Trump targeted because they voted evident. The state senate election, because they voted against the redistricting. So there were massive amounts of commercials in Chicago against these couple of these guys, and the commercials were so friggin' ignorant I can't even. Had to do with he voted to let a Chinese person buy a farm in Indiana, and we also know that's going to raise corn prices. You know, I think even people in Indiana realize that's pretty much a competitive market, and one farmer can't change the corn prices. But and they were talking about he acted like he didn't follow President Trump and everything he did and blah, blah. But these commercials must have. But I guess the math of this, and I look at the, you know, I consider it a. You know, embarrassment we have as a mayor here in the city. The way these elections are run now, the numbers are in the big primary here in Chicago. I know about that one. I think the guy got 90,000 votes. Then in the runoff, then you're like, oh, man, these are the two people running. I guess I'll pick the least worst. But you shouldn't. I don't think you should be able to get the mayor's job in Chicago with 3 million people here, 2.8, with 90,000 votes. Now, in Indiana, in these primaries, I'm going to say that Trump has, or you know, the Democrats probably do too. There's somebody who will have, you're going to get 20% of the vote from the MAGA people, on the Republican side, or 20 or 25. Now, it's almost like old people used to be. Those are the people that are going to vote. The Democrats do the same thing with the gay lesbian community. Those people vote. They're like old people used to be. I mean, you cater to the old people because they showed up at the polls. Well, the math is, if you can get, you know, 20% of the people in a district to show up for a primary, even though theoretically there's another 80%, they never show, Andrew. I mean, I almost think that if you could, in a primary, if you can get 10, what did Saul Alinsky say? That most revolutions only take 7% of the people? If you can get 7% of the people, or 10, to show up in a primary and vote your way, and the rest of the people don't even know they're voting for, I think you got a winner. But it's not what I would consider to be representative democracy. What happens there? Is this a flaw that's always been there? Is it more recent? Is it something that is a problem for the democracy? I think it is, but I want your opinion.
Well, I think it's a huge problem, but it may have bottomed out at least temporarily in the last couple of years, including maybe in this Indiana election. But when there's a force, often, hopefully, there's a counterforce. And so in this case, one of the implications that you didn't mention, but it's a very important implication, is it sent a message all through the Deep South that you have to stop all primary elections immediately and get rid of any place that has black congressmen. And so Tennessee, Louisiana, and other states are reacting both to the Indiana election results, primary election results, and the Supreme Court ruling a few days ago, and saying, okay, we got to stop the primaries, we got to redistrict, eliminate any city and gerrymander it, and make sure that the entire state is Republican. So that's one of the implications of Indiana. And the next day, and this is all happening this week, is people in Illinois, governors, and New York and elsewhere are saying, if you're going to do that and eliminate every single Democratic House seat in the Deep South, almost like the Civil War era, then maybe we'll just have to take gerrymandering that's already occurring in Illinois and elsewhere and make sure there's not one Republican in the state of Illinois or New York or California. And so it is temporarily a race to the bottom, but the reaction, hopefully, is whether it's listeners to this show or elsewhere, saying, no, we gotta not just hand over these primaries to the ultra partisans, and we gotta show up and vote and have our voices heard.
Well, but when you do that, you gotta be doing the math. You better be very careful. But let me ask you this. I mean, I sure as hell don't want people to be gerrymandered, all Democratic or all Republican. But I guess if you have a state like Illinois, because Illinois did this, by the way, the 5th congressional district here, Illinois started to get a Hispanic community, and you know, evidently not represented. Okay, so I don't know how legal it is. I'm all for, you know, lob a stone randomly somewhere in a state and have every district have four sides to it or five sides and just do it randomly. That would be me. Now, of course, nobody wants to do that, right, because you want your side and your other side. But I don't know how it ever became okay to essentially draw a district all around the Hispanic people so they have a person. I mean, because I think at the end of the day, now that thing is so... I probably told you guys this before, but Andrew, you'll know what I'm talking about. Wayne won't. There is a district, the 5th. It used to be Gutierrez forever, and now it's Chuy Garcia. Now he's not running, and he pulled a crap where he told everybody he was running the last day, said he wasn't, so the only person that had their signatures together was his chief of staff. You know, so she's like the only one in the election, which is pretty sucky, I think. But anyway, but there's a Hispanic community on the south side, Pilsen, and there's one on the north side, just west of me. Actually, my area used to be Hispanic, but then the uppies drove them all out years ago. Well, the district looks like a barbell. There's the south side group, and then it runs west, like a couple of blocks is all it takes, races up north because they have to be contiguous, and comes back with like one block on Belmont being the district until it reaches the other Hispanic community. And Andrew, I don't know if you still know your Chicago geography. When you take the Eisenhower Expressway out west, and then there's the Tri-State Tollway, and they run parallel for a while with maybe, I'm going to say, 300 yards between the two. Nobody lives there. That's the contiguous piece of property that hooks up the south side and the north side. But I think, but now it's to the point where there's probably enough Hispanics in the city, matter of fact, not probably, I'm sure there are, that you've now essentially have locked them in to only one, quote, Hispanic representative. Where if you did it randomly, they would probably be, they, if they all voted together, which I'm not sure they do, they would now be able to influence maybe two districts. So if you have, let's say in Texas, pick a southern state like you're talking about, if you have, you know, 70% Republicans, 30% Democrats, or 65-35, it's not 100-0, right? So if all of a sudden you essentially weaken the Republican spots, which you're going to do, the ones that are 90% Republican, and you weaken them by throwing some Democrats in there that, quote, don't have a voice, and all of a sudden the voting changes like 10%, you're in danger of losing everything.
Well, exactly, and this may be a year that totally proves that point. So to get the figures a little bit more closer through much of the Deep South, it's maybe often 62%, 38, with maybe a few votes, depending on the election, going to third party or fourth party candidates. But if you take a wave election, and that 62% goes down, and it's 10 points, which I think, if I'm doing math correctly, it's it's within the realm of possibility in a lot of these districts that the 12 points disappears, particularly if you have a third-party candidate. And the masterminds who created this plan end up out of office or losing. And this may be the year that that actually happens.
Well, how would you in Illinois, for instance, I mean, the southern part of the state is, I think, so Republican. How could you ever include those districts anywhere to where they became
Democrat?
Well,
here's how, and we've seen through the maps, it just takes it to a different degree, is if you totally give up almost on the idea that the member of Congress represents an identifiable district, and you just say, whether it's in Alabama or Illinois, we are going to eliminate the opposite party, it can be done, assuming there's not the reaction we just talked about. And one way is, let's say you have a district that goes like a thin line.
Yeah.
Forget about a squiggly line, like you're talking about it in the Hispanic created district, but you just have a line from part of Chicago out to halfway to Peoria, and another one from Chicago, you know, out to the eastern part of the state, and you just have a 2 mile or even half mile straight line district that goes out 50 miles.
Well,
for democracy, but maybe good in the very short run for whatever party's doing it.
I had experience with such a district back in 2004 when I was toying with the idea of running for the U.S. House in Northern Virginia against an incumbent Democrat, as I would have challenged him in the primary. But the 8th district was somewhat like you're describing, Chief, the one up there with the between the Hispanic districts. The 8th district, extremely liberal, was Arlington County and the town of Alexandria, both Democratic strongholds. But then there was this line that hugged the Dulles International Airport Access Road all the way out to Dulles, where it sort of exploded to take in where all these defense contractors were located. And the reason for that is they were the ones who were basically donating money to the incumbent's political war chest. Now, this didn't have much to do with demographics for voting, but it had a lot to do with making sure he was able to line his pockets. And you mentioned Indiana. I actually had nothing to do the other night and was monitoring the returns. The one person targeted by Trump who won was a guy named Good, who I think is down around West Lafayette, Terre Haute area. And the only reason it looks like he won is he had two challengers, two women. They both had the same last name, Wilson. So they tried to get one of them to pull out of the race, but refused. So if you added up their votes, you know, if one of them had dropped out, it's quite possible that incumbent would have also been defeated.
Well, I'm just looking here at the your buddy Bobby Rush is in the first congressional district now. One of the ladies who came on the show a couple of times, Taylor, what's her name? Karen Reeves. Absolutely spectacular lady. I met her at a fundraising. One of those people that when they talk to you, the whole world disappears. They're just talking to you. And you can't, yeah, you can't bug them. You can't say, come talk to me. She'll say, no, I'm talking to you, Wayne. I'll let you know when I'm done. One of those kind of people, her eyes just lock on. Brilliant lady.
Bill Clinton was a lot like that when I met him. I felt the same way.
You know who was like that was Carol Moseley Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever met her? But anyway, this lady was running for Bobby Rush's seat. He'd been there forever. She ended up losing it to Jesse Jackson's kid, because he got $1.5 million in the last couple of weeks from who's the guy that's in jail, the Bitcoin guy? See, and of course, Jesse's kid never gave it back, right? But this district comes from essentially the loop all the way out to, and they keep taking a bigger chunk of the burbs. It actually goes all the way down to Bourbon A, swings across to Manuka, Elwood, Manhattan, back through Homer Glen and those areas, and then sneaks up on a southwest thing back to essentially downtown. Now, the idea is we're going to take bigger chunks of, you know, what I suppose is more Republican areas down in, you know, below I-80. But you run the risk of, now you lost population out of Chicago. You lost the Robert Taylor homes, which had to be 30,000 people. you run the risk of losing it. I mean, you look at this map and you go, wait a minute, there's going to come a year where the guys down south where people are moving are going to have more population than the people in Chicago you think are carrying the district. And I bet there's people got to be working on this all the time, aren't they, wondering who's moving where?
Well, yeah, but here's the thing. It used to be only once every 10 years. So, you know, people would, you know, kind of plan for after the census and a year ending with a zero, like, you know, 2020 or whatever. But now it's, well, why not do it every 2 years?
Andrew, after a break, how did that start? Now they're trying to do it the same year, for God's sake. S&P futures up 10, NASDAQ futures up 15. It's after a huge rally yesterday. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks. Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years I've seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Remember, tomorrow is May 8th, and we are going to raise a glass to our heroes at Revolutionary Brewery, where a portion of all proceeds are going to Fisher House, the nonprofit that helps the veterans and their families during times that they need to go to the VA. Again, that is between 4 and 6 at 3340 North Kinsey. Back to you, Chief.
Jimmy, I'm going to say if Andrew and Wayne were in town, they'd be an easy pickup to take them there.
Yes, they'd serve beer.
Yeah, they would serve beer and whatever else. And Revolution Brew, you guys would be all in. SP Futures up 10, NASDAQ Futures up 18. We'll buzz through this quick because not much happened. Everything happened yesterday. Yesterday was a story. Dow was up 612, S&P up 105. Yeah, 105, that's 1.5%. The NASDAQ was up 512, that's 2%. Yesterday was a huge day over in Europe. Today we got the DAX down 34. That's a little bit because they were up a bunch yesterday. 0.1%. FTSE down 63. That's 0.6%. CAC around down 8. Call that flat. Asia, Nikkei up 3,300. It's 6% because they're catching up to us yesterday. Topped 62,000 for the first time. And they keep saying as Asia markets look past Trump's Iran threats, it has nothing to do with that. Trust me. It's all about money in the system. Hang Seng up 412. 1.6%. Shanghai up 19.8%. 0.4. The South Korea is increasing their money supply by almost 7% a year, going right in the market, just like it is here. Bonds down 2 base points, 4.33. We've got oil down 3 day. We're almost down to 90, 91.20. RBOB is down to 337. It was pushing 380 or something, 375, so that's a big move down. Gold up again today, up $51, 47.45. Silver up $4. That's almost 6%, 81.67. Foreign exchange, kind of right where we've been, 117. Actually, the dollar's down a little bit. The euro's almost at 118, and the British pound's at 136. So the dollar is dropping. That's why the gold is up. Crypto, down 334, but still higher at 81,058. Jimmy, real quick, traffic, weather, sports. Cubs win again, extra innings.
Yes, Cubs win 14 in a row. They are the top team right now that have won in extra innings. I think they have won 5 ball games in a row in extra innings.
That's really something.
Well, Chief, it is May 7th, and we are in Phoenix. It is clear, mostly sunny. Use sunscreen because it'll be a high of 98 and a low of 69, and right now they're at 66. Then vice versa here in Chicago. We're at 46 degrees and a high of 56. As we said, let's take a quick look at the traffic. The inbound Kennedy to the Jane Byrne is at 26 minutes. Inbound Eden is now at 44 from Lake Cook Inn to the Jane Byrne interchange. The inbound Eisenhower is also at 44 minutes. And the inbound Dan Ryan is at 29. Back to you.
Andrew, you have no idea how much last week's show, and sometimes it's Wayne that gets me with the zinger that lasts all week, and I talk about it in other shows. Last week it was you when I asked you about the Supreme Court. What if nobody pays attention to them? There's no enforcement there, and you said there was some idea that the people in government, there would be a sort of a gentleman's agreement where how people would behave, where the Supreme Court, and you mentioned that Lincoln didn't do that for the Civil War and so forth, but I mean, most of the time it's sort of been right, and it all of a sudden this all seemed to me, and I'm not blaming him specifically, but in my industry I'm going to blame Cheney, because I think that a lot of people, the amount of people in Congress, didn't spend their day trading like they do now, because Cheney basically said, I'm not putting my crap in a blind trust, I'm trading my stuff, and everybody said okay. There was no real, the gentleman's agreement seemed to have just went right down the drain sort of instantly, and now it seems like it's happening all over the place. I mean, you would think that you would redistrict when there's a census. Now people, they're gonna redistrict 2 weeks before the election if they can. When did, you know, and I see people driving on a shoulder 100 miles an hour, and if you say, tell somebody about it, they go, oh man, you should see it in Miami. I don't care about Miami. I don't care about the guy who just buzzed by me 100 miles. How all of a sudden did we, and I know you believe that we're going to come back to being normal someday. Is there anything that these people think now that they can just not do? I mean, is there any sort of gentleman's agreement, some sort of a, heaven forbid it's a law, but any kind of convention, any sort of anything that has made sense that people feel holds?
Well, first let's define who these people are, because most people, whether it's probably on a local government or elsewhere, are just trying to do the right thing and so forth. So we're really talking about the people who are focused on power, some of whom don't have any, but they are foot soldiers for willing to do anything to become famous or attach themselves to the so-called leaders. But to get to your point, how did it happen? Well, gerrymandering, and I'm sure you know this, but let me just lay it out for all the listeners, including new young people who might be not aware of it, but the term gerrymander goes way back to the early 1800s, and it was named after a congressman, Elbridge Gerry from Massachusetts, and he was able to create a district that looked like a salamander, and so ever since it's been called gerrymanders when you do this stuff. And when they were kind of isolated instances, people just accepted it as, you know, part of the political process. But the people who are supposed to know better, like the Supreme Court and U.S. senators, have that are supposed to be above this, because senators, they've got an entire state, so they can't be gerrymandered. The Supreme Court, they get a lifetime appointment. They're supposed to look out for the good of the country. But they've become totally partisan. And so that's why the guardrails are off now, because their decision-making, you know, with some exceptions, but on this issue, just is whatever helps my party, whether I'm a Supreme Court justice or U.S. senator, all too often they say, let's do it.
Well, it just seems like every... The idea, and I love Wayne's opinion here, but when you talk about... You're right, gerrymandering goes back, you know, to whatever, when goes back to Troy and Greece or something, whatever, but at least there was some sort of a limit. You did it every 10 years. You know, and then somebody would say, yeah, well, you know, even though maybe it never was right from the get-go, there was some governor on it. My guys at Pullman, when you work at a place that, you know, has a couple thousand people working there, you're going to get people from all walks of life. And there were a few people there that were jockeys. And I never talked to them personally, but one of my best friends, Bob Johnson, would say every week they would have, on some nondescript race, they would have a jockeys race that was rigged. And all the jockeys could bet no more than $50 on the horse that was going to win or place or whatever. If you ever bet 60, all of a sudden you showed up at work with a broken leg. I mean, because there was a limit, because they didn't all want to get caught. You know, and if somebody went too far, but now we seem to have no barriers whatsoever. I mean, if you were riding a bike in Chicago on the north side, and you stop for a stop sign, you're going to get a bike tire right up your ass. I mean, they're going to say, what are you doing? I mean, it seems like there is no barrier whatsoever. Everybody gets to make up their own morality right now. Lou had a term for it. It's something about your morality that's individualized. You get to decide what's right and wrong. You don't go to church anymore. You don't have any nuns. You get to figure out what's right and wrong for you. You know, if 90 miles an hour and 45 is okay, that's okay, because it's, you don't think it's excessive, and you get to make that call. I see it up and down the whole society. It's not just in Washington. Now, whether they started it or they're reflective of it, I don't know. I guess I'll never get the answer to that question. I mean, nobody seems to care if all of a sudden somebody goes, well, we're going to redo these districts 5 months before the election. Okay, what's the matter with that? There's nobody thinks for a second to go, wait, what if we did that all day long? I mean, at the end of the day, regardless of all this crap, if we go to elections in November, how much time and money has been spent on this? And I think we're going to end up about even from where we started, won't we?
Well, it could be. Let me take a little issue when you say nobody seems to care. I actually think a lot of people care, ordinary people who are getting more involved in the political process than they thought they had to. I think what you mean is some of the people who are supposed to care because they're have power, a lot of them don't seem to care.
Well, the three of us care. We wouldn't be at this hour in the morning talking about it, but caring is not the same as being able to do anything about it.
Yes, yes.
Well, you know, the other thing about the redistricting is it's always been based on a 10-year census. And there, too, we may have an issue because Trump and his people have made no secret of the fact that they don't like the way the census is conducted. The census is, by law, to count everyone, not just U.S. citizens, not just registered voters, but green card people, people that are here, even those who are undocumented, because that's how the budget is, you know, directed to certain districts based on social needs. And if they start to mess with the census, for which the redistricting has always been based, it's just another point at which these criminal masterminds of Project 2025 and the Heritage Foundation and groups like it can further manipulate the voters to where it becomes ironclad that the politicians pick their voters rather than the voters picking their politicians.
Wayne, if you had to say, I mean, I've read bits and pieces of this 2025, and I vaguely know where if they're 100%, I'll use the term successful, what does the world look like? You know, 100,000 white people having all the money in the place, and everybody else is a slave or what? Or a shadow? And what is their idea of a perfect world?
Yeah, well, you know, this is very worrisome. You look at the stuff being pushed by Peter Thiel, who, by the way, has made no secret of the fact that he despises the Pope and the Vatican. He's even talking about the Pope being the Antichrist. I mean, he's far gone. Him and Elon Musk, two birds of a feather, friends since they were kids. They're talking in terms of a technological dictatorship. And the first move towards that is where we see these massive grassroots protests against these data centers in states like Indiana, for example. And that was apparently an issue. And I would take some issue with the political people that night of the Indiana election. They were saying, well, look, in places like South Bend, and I know you're familiar with that area, places like around Purdue and in the Indianapolis area, they said, you know, Indiana's an open primary state. They said, well, maybe some of those Democrats will cross over and support the people being targeted by Trump as sort of a message to Trump. I looked at that. I said, no way do they want a quote-unquote, there are not really moderate Republicans in Indiana. They're all conservative. But I said, there's no way the Democrats are going to cross over and vote for somebody that could win in November in the general. And it looks like that's exactly what happened. There was no vote for these anti-Trump state senators in South Bend or down.
Wayne, is every state, I seem to recall this, way, way, way back, like in high school, can every state, can you cross over? I mean, in Illinois, they ask you which one you want, but in some states you can't do that, right?
Yeah, they're closed primaries. And I believe that the situation we have here in Florida is that way. And the problem is that when a closed primary means those who are registered as independents, you know, they don't get to play in any of the reindeer games.
I mean, really? You know, an independent can't... See, in Illinois, I think it's open. But how do they... I don't see them keeping track. The last time I grabbed a Democratic ballot, I mean, are they keeping track? I don't know. I don't think so.
Well, one thing that's very worrisome, but it's like... Oh, I don't know. It's like a spread of some deadly disease. It's an... increments, maybe, or at least in olden times it was, but the collection of data, not only on all of our personal lives, but now election data by the central government in Washington, is extremely worrisome in the age of computers, artificial intelligence, because what Trump and these folks are doing when they seize all the voting records of a state or a city, which they're trying to do increasingly and with some success, is then they can match up, oh, chief, he's registered this way. Well, what can we do to discourage this registration? Or more precisely, if you have, let's take a name, John Jackson, and you say, well, he sounds like a Democrat. Oh, he is a Democrat. Well, there was a John Jackson arrested 10 years ago. Let's get rid of all the John Jacksons as criminals and void their registration so that when they show up to vote, they can't vote because they're on a list of people who are taken off the list as former criminals, even if it's a different guy in a different state.
And had that not been done in Florida in the 2000 election, we would have had President Gore.
Yeah, that was done. The great myth that some of us have researched, not to a granular level, but we know the researchers who have. The great myth is that it was 500 Chads that decided the election, and then the Supreme Court voted on party lines to stop the vote count and install the candidate Bush as president. Well, actually, there were 100,000 people who were mysteriously dropped from the voting rolls just before the election, and they show up, and this is now 26 years ago, the 2000 election, and they show up, and they say, well, you can't vote, you're not eligible, and who are you going to complain to at that point in time? Maybe you complain to some local volunteer at the election headquarters, but there's no way to tabulate it without some governmental power to take a look at what's going on. And since that election caper worked, that leads to the current day problems, which is extremely insidious, particularly with the growth of computers that can track this. And if the federal government has seized all the voting records for Fulton County, which is Atlanta and Georgia, and imagine if they're able to match up which are registered Democrats and make life miserable for them, Georgia will never have any two-party system again, if that is allowed to stand. And yet the Democratic Party and other mainstream news organizations do not want to touch this because they say, well, it'll hurt public confidence if we even investigate it. So it's not even being investigated by the main opinion leaders. And you know, Wayne and I are closely involved with the mainstream media so that we know that that's the thinking. It's the editors don't want investigation of that kind of story unless you can prove it 100%. Well, you can't prove it 100% if you don't even start.
Well, a quick comment on the Florida situation, and then I have a question about my own situation here. I'll do mine first. In Illinois, again, that's why I'm asking you guys, because you're from different states or have been in different states, even though I know Andrew is a Southsider at heart. Even though you were born here, it was like a birthright thing, Andrew. I don't know if you knew that or not. But
thank you.
But I wander down the block. I've been going there 20-some years. They used to have a book. I don't know that I ever declared one way or the other. They would check me in the book, and they would say, Democrat or Republican. Well, even if you're a Republican in Chicago, you're going to grab the Democratic ballot because there's nobody on the Republican ballot, right? It's like a half a sheet of paper. So, I mean, there's that kind of crossover just because you go there to do something, right? I don't think they have any idea which one I grabbed. I've never seen them mark it down. Or anything like that. Now the book is on computer with your signature in there. And so here, I don't think they have a clue. They might have guessed that in my district, you know, 80% of the people grabbed a Democrat thing, but they don't know if I'm really a Democrat or not. I mean, I don't know what they would, and they don't know whether I'm the 80 or the 20. I don't think.
Have you ever gone door to door? Maybe not. You're more of an independent type of guy. But here's something that both parties do, is when they go door to door, what they tell people before an election is, don't try to debate people. We're going to give you a list of who's in the party according to registration. Go to them and ask them to vote. And if our statistics are wrong, don't get into a debate with people. You're not going to change anybody's mind. Just get the people out and off, out of the house to vote.
Okay.
So they do have some capabilities like that, and that's how the parties use them. But what I'm talking about is a whole new level of malfeasance, corruption.
Oh, I'm absolutely with you on that. I'm trying to get to is in my spot, it would be kind of tough because Illinois is an open primary. But the other place is that much easier to get this information, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, and they already have it to some extent in a lot of places. It depends how well funded the parties are.
Well, Andrew, from a guy who's never experienced this, start from the beginning. If my place was a closed primary state, if I walk in and I say, "Hey, give me the Republican ballot or the independent," they're not going to give it to me. I have to take the Democratic one. How do I can't change it ever or what?
You can, here in Florida, you can actually switch parties right then and there. But you're making a commitment that, yes, I will be a loyal whatever. And then you get to vote in that primary. And then conceivably in the next one, you could switch back and say, oh, no, I'm registering with the other party.
See, I've never experienced anything like that. So you're saying if you're an independent, they don't give you either one?
That's right. I mean, why go vote if it's unless you're an independent that wants to register same day in one of the other parties, and then you got to do a loyalty thing, which is not worth the paper it's printed on.
That's so far distant from what I've from here. But in regards to Florida, Andrew, you mentioned it. I think two things. One is, I think Gore got kind of screwed from what you were talking about. But everybody forgets how Bush got screwed. And when I say this, you're not supposed to declare a victor until the polls close. And as I recall in 2000, I have a memory like you guys, the idiotic news media didn't realize that a significant portion of Florida is in the central time zone. So they called Gore as the victor when the people in the panhandle still had another hour to vote. I think that, again, I'd rather had Gore in there. I think that hurt Bush a lot. Do you?
Well, yeah, but it's not necessarily a conspiracy.
No, I'm just saying.
Whereas here's what I was talking about, and you can compare it. It's an apple or oranges. Somebody on some news station made this prediction, and maybe they shouldn't have, although, again, there's no law. I don't think at the time that you can't make a prediction. It's an honor system among the media, or was. But here's what I'm talking about. There's a researcher, a fellow MBA from the University of Chicago, as I think you are, named Greg Palast, who's done data analysis, and out of his reporting and books about this kind of thing, we see that in Florida there was a contract for a kind of database company, a few $1,000s a year, to check on whether people were still alive before elections. And that contract of a few $1,000s a year was changed by the administration of Jeb Bush, the brother of the presidential candidate, of course, who was governor, and Kathleen Harris, to a multi-million dollar contract with a different database company. And you go from a few $1,000s to do checks to multi-million dollars. And you think, well, what's the state of Florida getting out of the multi-million dollar contract? And it turns out, according to Palast's books and research, and he wrote this up for the BBC and elsewhere, that 100,000 voters were knocked out without being notified that they were knocked out, and that they then went to the polls and couldn't vote. And so if you compare what you were talking about to this multi-million dollar strategy, to knock out people who might vote Democrat based on their previous registration. It's not the same thing.
Oh, I agree. But, you know, here's where we don't have that much time, but my concern is with, you know, of course, anybody who's on the Republican side, you mention anything about the Electoral College, and they're ready to fight you, right? To me, you know, I was never a statistician. I mean, our buddy Hal Snar sure is, but when they got done with all this screw around in Florida, my conclusion then and today is, guys, this is a statistical dead heat. They should split these votes. I mean, there's no way anybody could say one guy or the other won. It was that close. Am I right or wrong? I mean, the idea that somehow all these votes have to go one way is so insane to me, I can't even go there. Now, whether it's an electoral college, I mean, I don't like the fact that Illinois is quote, the blue state, where the people in southern Illinois, why should they even walk down the block? What's the point of it?
It makes sense what you're saying, except for people who care about reform, I think it has to be separated into what's feasible, what's viable, what's practical, and what's not. And to make some kind of changes, like on the Electoral College or term limits for the U.S. Supreme Court, you need a constitutional amendment, which you're never going to have.
Why?
Because it would take too many states, too many people that just block it.
Reason why I ask is, I'm agreeing with you 100%, which I'm not supposed to do, right? I agree with you 100% that's too big of a change. But I don't see why we can't all go with the Nebraska model, where the electoral vote in every representative district, I mean, if there's one, it's 90% Democrat somewhere in North Dakota, they should get their one spot.
Oh, you could. You can. And the next part of what I'm saying is, yeah, rule out reforms that are practically impossible, but there are workarounds that will achieve just what you're describing. And one is a compact that's only a few states away from ratification, where I forget some of the details, maybe Wayne.
Yeah, the winner of the national popular vote are awarded that state's electoral votes.
Okay, it's not quite what you're saying, but it's a workaround that could be replicated maybe on the Electoral College, and it's easier to do than a constitutional amendment.
Well, how did they pull it off in Nebraska? Because what do they have, Wayne? They got like three representatives. And whoever wins the representative district gets the one electorate.
Right. By congressional district. So it's.
Well, Maine is like that too.
Yeah, Maine did the same thing. And Nebraska, I'm somewhat familiar with. I helped a U.S. Senate candidate there a few years ago in his campaign. But it's all red except for Omaha. And that district, which is currently represented by a anti-Trump Republican retired general, that is the one that is always seen as a probable Democratic electoral vote.
But I mean, in Illinois, as much as I may not like, I voted for as many Republicans as I have there, but say I really didn't like the Republican guy. Well, Illinois shouldn't be all Democrat. It should be, you know, 12-3 or 11-4 or something like that.
Sure.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how anybody could say I'm wrong. Why should somebody get no representation?
Well, what the Democrats are saying, look, the Republicans have started this game of redistricting, we're going to meet them and beat them.
What's the last question? Because we're running. What? The guy in, is it Louisiana or something? Now, they're trying to do it, you know, 5 months before the election. Now he's saying he's got a stop deal. What's he saying? What's going on?
Well, the voting has already started in the primaries, and Jeff Landry, the Republican governor, who, by the way, Trump appointed as his emissary to Greenland to help us fight Denmark and Greenland, So in addition to being governor of Louisiana, he's running around trying to break up NATO over Greenland. But he immediately, after the Supreme Court decision, stopped the election, even though there's already votes have been cast, and they went to the legislature and got a new map approved, and it's to get rid of Democrats and blacks. And the Democrats, you know, they can either say, fine, we'll take the high road and not try to do anything similar, or they can say, this is a battle for the future of the country. If they're going to do this and eliminate every Democrat and black representative in the Deep South, we got to fight back.
Well, yeah, and Virginia did it. And yesterday, Kash Patel sicked his FBI agents on the architect of that Virginia redistricting, the president pro tem of the Senate, a woman named Lucas.
82-year-old black lady, her home was raided by Kash Patel's FBI. So this has gone from academic pieties on reform to police state tactics. Go after this black grandmother legislator, raid her house, you know, impoverish her with legal fees for what?
Well, the we got a dash, guys, but some one of the, I heard this Republican guy say a couple weeks ago, if we lose, we're all going to jail.
He's right.
But I don't want that for the next 4 years either. I'd like these guys to do actually some governing instead of all this other crap they're doing. Anyway, guys, good stuff. What are you guys doing this weekend?
Me, I'm staying in out of the 90-degree weather here.
I'm going to watch my college play in the lacrosse NCAA tournament with my college roommate, who reminds me that we got to stay true to the school. So we'll be doing that together.
Well, the Irish won that like last year, the year before. They had like three brothers that were from the East, and those guys were unbelievable. They were all from the same family.
Well, it changes every couple of years in college. The school I'm talking about, Cornell, was the national champion last year. But, of course, with graduation, they were lucky to get into the tournament. So we'll see.
Well, good luck with that, guys. SP Futures up 7, NASDAQ Futures up 13. Again, it's the follow-up on yesterday's huge day. At least we're not down. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.